This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents, Is Everyone Hanging Out Without Me? And Other Concerns, by Mindy Kaling. This is Mindy Kaling. Hello. Introduction. Thank you for buying this audiobook. Or, if my publisher's research analytics are correct, thank you, Ants of America, for buying this for your niece you don't know that well but really want to connect with more. There are many teenage vampire books you could have purchased instead. I'm grateful you made this choice. I thought I'd take a minute to answer some questions.
What is this book about?
In this book, I write a lot about romance, female friendships, unfair situations that now seem funny in retrospect, unfair situations that I still don't think are funny, my childhood, heartache, and my job. Just that really hardcore, masculine stuff that men love to read about. I wrote this book in a way that reflects how I think. Sometimes it's an essay or a story, and sometimes it's a pleist, which is a piece with a listy quality. That's a term I just made up right now.
Is this one of those guidebooks celebrities write for girls?
Oh, hell no. I'm only marginally qualified to be giving advice at all. My body mass index is certainly not ideal. I frequently use my debit card to buy things that cost less than $3 because I never have cash on me. And my bedroom is so untidy that it looks like vandals ransacked the Anthropology sales section. I'm kind of a mess. I did, however, fulfill a childhood dream of writing and acting in television and movies. Armed with that confidence, alongside a lifelong love of the sound of my own voice, yes, I've put some advice in this book. However, you should know that I disagree with a lot of traditional advice. For instance, they say the best revenge is living well. I say it's acid in the face. Who will love them now? Another old saying is that revenge is a dish best served cold, but it feels best served piping hot, straight out of the oven of outrage. My opinion? Take care of that revenge right away. Push, shove, scratch that person while they're still within arm's reach. Don't let them get away. Who knows when you're going to get this opportunity again?
Do you offer up a lot of opinions in this book?
A little bit. I do lay in some opinions here and there. For example, I don't think it should be socially acceptable for people to say that they are bad with names. No one is bad with names. That is not a real thing. Not knowing people's names isn't a neurological condition, it's a choice. You choose not to make learning people's names a priority. It's like saying, hey, a disclaimer about me? I'm rude. For heaven's sake, if you don't know someone's name, just pretend you do. Do that thing everyone else does where you vaguely say, nice to see you, and make weak eye contact.
So is this book like a women's magazine?
Not really, but if it reads like a really funny magazine, I'll be psyched. I love magazines. You can't walk by a magazine and not sit down and read it. You try to throw away a magazine, and if you don't push it down in the trash enough, it somehow resurfaces on the floor of your TV room. I know this because I swear my house has been haunted by the same December 2004 issue of Glamour magazine for the past 7 years.
I'm buying this book for my daughter, whom I'm trying to reconnect with after my acrimonious divorce from her mother. Would this help me seem like a cool, understanding dad?
Honestly, I think you should just buy her some kind of SUV. This is what all the divorced dads did for their kids in my high school. A Land Rover, something like that. If you don't have that kind of money, I would just suggest reconciling with the mom.
I don't know. I have a lot of books already. I wanted to finish those Girl with the Dragon Tattoo books before the movies came out.
This book will take you 2 days to read. Even less because this is an audiobook and you just have to sit back and listen to it. Did you even see the cover? Can you see the cover as an audiobook? Okay, just take it from me. It's mostly pink. If you're listening to this every night for months, something's not right.
This sounds okay, but not as good as Tina Fey's book. Why isn't this more like Tina Fey's book?
Look, I know, man. Tina's awesome. I think she has every major international trophy for excellence except a Heisman. She might actually have an honorary Heisman. I should check that out. Unfortunately, I can't be Tina, because it's very difficult to lure her into one of those Freaky Friday-type situations where we can switch bodies, even though in the movies they make it look so easy. Believe me, I've tried. I suggest you buy Bossy Pants again if you like her so much. I did. I have like 5 copies of it.
What else should I know?
I think there's probably only 2 things. 1, there is no sunrise so beautiful that it is worth waking me up to see it. And 2, I would like to be friends with Beyoncé Knowles. I just think that's kind of important for you to know before you continue listening to this audiobook. Well, I think I've covered everything and I've still maintained an air of sexy mystery about myself. I feel good about this. Love, Mindy. Alternate titles for this book. Here are some titles for my book that I really liked but was advised strongly not to use. The Girl with No Tattoo. When Your Boyfriend Fits Into Your Jeans and Other Atrocities. The Book That Was Never a Blog. Always Wear Flats and Have Your Friends Sleep Over, a step-by-step how-to guide for avoiding getting murdered. Harry Potter Secret Book Number 8. Sometimes you just have to put on lip gloss and pretend to be psyched. I Want Dirk Nowitzki to Host Saturday Night Live so much that I'm making it the title of my book. Barf Me to Death, and other things I've been known to say. The Last Mango in Paris. This title would work best if Mango were the cheeky nickname for an Indian woman, and if I had spent any time in Paris. So you've just finished Chelsea Handler's book. Now what? Deep Dish Pizza in Afghanistan. A touching novel about a brave girl enjoying Chicago-style pizza in secret Taliban-ruled Kabul. There has ceased to be a difference between my awake clothes and my asleep clothes. I don't know how she does it, but I suspect she gets help from illegal immigrants. I Forget Nothing, A Sensitive Kid Looks Back. Chubby for Life. I don't remember a time when I wasn't chubby. Like being Indian, being chubby feels like it is just part of my permanent deal. I remember being in first grade in Mrs. Gilmore's class at Fisk Elementary School and seeing that Ashley Kemp, the most popular girl in her class, weighed only 37 pounds. We knew this because we weighed her on the industrial postal scale they kept in the teacher supply closet. I was so envious. I snuck into the supply closet later that same day to weigh myself. I was a whopping 68 pounds. Some of the first math I understood was that I was closer to twice Ashley's weight than to her weight. Don't be closer to twice a friend's weight than to her actual weight, I told myself. This little mantra has helped me stave off obesity for more than 2 decades. My mom's a doctor, but because she came from India and then Africa, where childhood obesity was not a problem, she put no premium on having skinny kids. In fact, she and my dad didn't mind having a chubby daughter. Part of me wonders if it even made them feel kind of prosperous, like, have you seen our overweight Indian child? Do you know how statistically rare this is? It will then not come to you as a surprise that I've never been thin in my life, except the day I was born when I was 6 pounds. It's a small point of pride that I was a 6-pound baby, because from my limited understanding of baby weights, that's on the skinnier side. I flaunt my low baby weight the way really obese people must flaunt their dainty small feet. It's my little claim to skinny fame. From then on, it was full speed ahead food paradise. In grade school, I would vacillate along the spectrum from chubby to full-on fat until I was about 14. Being overweight is so common in America and comes in so many forms that you can't just call someone fat and have the reasonable expectation that they will understand you. So, here's my breakdown. Chubby. A regular-sized person who could lose a few, for whom you feel affection. Chubster. An overweight, adorable child. That kid from Two and a Half Men for the first couple years. Fatso. An antiquated term, really. In the 1970s, mean sorority girls would call a pledge this. Probably most often used on people who aren't even really fat, but who fear being fat. Fatass. Not usually used to describe weight, actually. This deceptive term is more a reflection of one's laziness. In the writer's room of the office, an upper-level writer might get impatient and yell, Eric, take your fat ass and those 6 fat asses and go write this B story. I don't want to hear any more excuses why the plot doesn't make any sense. Obese. A serious, non-pejorative way to describe someone who is unhealthily overweight. Obesitron. A nickname you might give someone you adore who just stepped on your foot accidentally and it hurt. Alternatively, a fat robot. Overweight. When someone is roughly 30 pounds too heavy for his or her frame. Pudgy. The same as chubby. Pudgo. The same as chubster. Jabba the Hutt. Primarily a Star Wars villain. Also, something you can call yourself after a really filling Thanksgiving dinner. Your aunts and uncles will really laugh hard at this. Tub of lard. A huge compliment given by Depression-era people to other, less skinny people. Whale. A really, really mean way that teen boys target teen girls. For more on whale, listen to the following anecdote. Duante Diallo. There have been 2 times in my life, ages 14 and 19, when I lost a ton of weight over a short period of time. At 14, I lost the weight because of Duante Diallo. In ninth grade, my class was made up mostly of the same kids with whom I'd gone to middle school, with the exception of about 20 splashy new kids. One of these students was Duante. Duante Diallo was a handsome kid from Senegal who'd moved to Boston to play soccer for our school. He was immediately the star forward of our varsity soccer team. We had a not-great, artsy, private school-type soccer team, the kind made up of slender boys whose primary goal was to seem well-rounded for college applications. But you could tell Duante would have been the star of even a really good team. He was beloved by teachers because he was a brave kid for being so far away from his parents, and beloved by students because he was good-looking, a jock, and had an interesting African accent. Also, people couldn't believe the stuff he had done in Senegal, like smoke, drive a car, have sex, live in a village, and hold a gun. When he was introduced at a student assembly, he chose to give a short speech where he taught us a sports cheer from Senegalese soccer matches. In the hallways, small crowds would form around Duante as he shared stories from his past. Once he shot a cow with an AK-47. He was so popular you could barely look at him without being blinded by cool. Duante was also, unfortunately, a tyrannical asshole. Maybe I should have gleaned this from the joy with which he told a story about murdering a cow with a massive gun. He fixated on me early in the year as being overweight, and he was open about his observations. At first, it had the veneer of niceness. For example, once I was getting a drink of water in the hallway, where he and his friends were standing. Duante.
You would actually be really pretty if you lost weight.
His face was gentle and earnest, as though what he had really said was, "You remind me of a sunset in my native Senegal." It was confusing. All I could muster as a reply to this insulting comment was, "Thank you?" I was hurt, but I rationalized that maybe Duante had only been around really thin African girls his entire third world life, and he didn't know that American girls had access to refrigeration, and that we didn't need to divide up UN food parcels with our neighbors. Look, this might have been a tad racist an assumption on my part, but we were both in the wrong. By winter, I had not lost any weight, and in fact had gained about 10 more pounds. This really bothered Duante. I think he felt he had gone out of his way to give me some valuable advice, and I had chosen not to follow it, therefore insulting him. One day in February, I walked into the freshman center. He stopped mid-conversation with his friends and gestured to me. Duante.
Speaking of whales.
I don't even think they were talking about whales. The guys all laughed, but even I could tell they felt guilty doing it. I'd been friends with most of them since we were kids. Danny Feinstein, who was my Latin study buddy, came up to me later that afternoon and told me that what Duante said wasn't cool. He had a stoic look of a noble do-gooder, although he had said nothing to defend me at the time of the insult. Again, I was forced to say, "Thank you." How I continually found myself in situations where I felt I had to say thank you to mean guys, I'm not sure. It was a tough winter. I had gone from competitive, bookish nerd to nervous target. If this was Heathers, I was Martha Dumbtruck, and this mean African kid was all three Heathers. I turned my obsessive teenage energy away from reading Mad Magazine and focusing on my diet. I didn't have access to a lot of weight loss resources because this is pre-internet. There was one Weight Watchers near us, but it shared a mini-mall parking lot with a sketchy Salvation Army, and my parents didn't like the idea of taking me there for meetings. So I invented a makeshift diet formula. I would eat exactly half of what was put in front of me and no dessert. Without exercising, I lost 30 pounds in about 2 months. A janitor at school who I liked, Mrs. Carrington, would see me and say, "You got a metabolism on you, don't you, girl?" The janitors were always in my corner. I remember waking up in the morning and looking down at my fingers and seeing that they had shrunk overnight. Suddenly, I was freezing all the time, like those skinny girls in the movie theaters that are always complaining about being cold, and I needed to sleep with an extra wool blanket. My face thinned out, my belly went away. I stopped wearing oversized college sweatshirts and corduroy pants with elastic waists. Light brown lines appeared in my upper inner arms that actually looked like little rivers headed towards my shoulder blades. I actually thought they looked pretty until my mom told me that they were stretch marks from losing so much weight so fast. It was like I was a Disney sci-fi movie. Mom was impressed, but she didn't want me to go overboard, which was impossible because I was still eating a lot. I just had taken a break from eating like a professional football player. I loved all the side effects of losing weight, but the main reason I did it was so that Duante would stop making fun of me, so that I could hang out in the freshman center again, and not where I had been, which was across the street in the Fairy Woods. The Fairy Woods, in case you're wondering, was a small foresty park by the Charles River. This is where bad kids and frustrated teachers went to smoke. It was rumored to be a place where gay men had anonymous sex. This is why it was maturely dubbed the Fairy Woods. I did not put this together until I was 25. I thought Duante would finally leave me alone, but he didn't. One day, I was walking down the hallway to class and passed Duante and a group of his friends. Duante.
Remember when Mindy was like,
blowing out his cheeks to make a fat face?
A whale?
They all laughed. Come on, dude. Remember when? I'm getting made fun of because I used to be fat? The laws of bullying allowed you to be cruel even when the victim had made strides for improvement? This is when I realized that bullies, they don't have a code of conduct. Lucky for me, Duante was a bad student. English was his second language, and that made everything harder for him. I delighted in the fact that he had to go to the middle school to take some of his classes. Sophomore year, he broke his leg when he slipped in mud during a game and collided with another student. For a short time, he was even more popular, as sports injuries tend to make most people. But soon enough, his crutches were tedious to people when he was slow-moving and hard to get around in the hallway. He didn't play that season, and was never as good at soccer after his injury. He dropped out junior year, and I heard he got a girl pregnant. Part of me now feels a little bad for Duante Diallo. But not at the time. I was so happy. That fucking mean Senegalese kid. An intervention. I stayed at a pretty normal weight until college, when I put on the freshman 35 in the first 6 months. What's that? You've never heard of the freshman 35? That's funny, because neither had my parents, who welcomed me home on spring vacation with mild horror. I was a vaguely familiar food monster who had eaten their daughter. When I lost weight at 19, it was significant because that was the first time when I started exercising. I had always successfully avoided exercise as a kid, by being an extra in school plays or signing up for fakey sports like Tai Chi, or manipulating gym teachers into letting me read books in the bleachers. So, it was at Dartmouth College in 1999 that I discovered exercise when my best friend Brenda taught me how to run. I was a sloth upon whom Brenda took pity, and she saved me from near obesity with the patience and tenacity of Annie Sullivan, the miracle worker. Our workout routine was simple and mind-numbingly repetitive, an atmosphere in which I flourished, oddly. I started out walking for 20 minutes, and then Bren would make me do little spurts of running between lampposts or street signs. For the record, Bren, a natural athlete, runs like a 6-minute mile. This was an absolute waste of time for her. She was just doing this out of her well-brought-up Catholic kindness. More about Brenda later. Then we'd come back to her apartment and do abs of steel together. Even though we mercilessly made fun of the video, which was from the deep 80s and included Tammy Lee Webb, wearing aqua bike shorts and a pink thong leotard, we did that tape religiously. Tammy Lee had a rock-hard butt, and there was nothing ironic about it. The whole experience was surprisingly fun and cemented a friendship between Brenda and me for life. How can you not make a best friend out of the girl who has seen the sweat-soaked pelvis area of your gym pants daily, and who still chooses to spend time with you? In this safe and friendly setting, I lost 30 pounds in one semester. I love diets. I wish I could just be one of those French women you read about who stays thin by eating only the most gourmet foods in tiny aesthetic proportions, but I could never do that. First of all, I largely don't like gourmet food. I like frozen yogurt. I think it tastes better than ice cream. I like diet soda. When I drink juice or regular soda, it makes my blood sugar spike and I act like a cracked out Rachel Ray, but without any of the helpful household tips. I even like margarine, though everyone tells me it's basically poison or whatever. So that's one thing I have going against me. Another obstacle is that my pattern is to eat exactly as much as whoever is hanging out with me. And between boyfriends and my tall athletic friends, we're a bunch of huge eaters. I really do have a remarkable appetite. I remember when the news report came out about Michael Phelps' 10,000 calorie a day diet, and everyone was so shocked. But I just thought, yep, I could do that, no problem. Ultimately, the main reasons why I will be chubby for life are, one, I have virtually no hobbies except dieting. I can't speak any non-English languages, knit, ski, scrapbook, or cook. I have no pets. I don't know how to do drugs because no one showed me. I lost my passport 3 years ago when I moved into my house and never got it renewed, so I can't travel. Video games scare me because they all seem to simulate situations I'd hate to be in, like war or stealing cars. So if I ever lost weight, I would also lose my only hobby. Two. I have zero discipline, like none. I'm like if Private Benjamin had never toughened up, but in fact got worse. Three, guys I've dated have been into me the way I am. And four, I'm pretty happy with the way I look, as long as I don't break a beach chair. My love of dieting is a recent realization. It turns out I have a passion for trying out new eating plans and exercises. Dukan, South Beach, French women don't get fat, cavemen don't get fat, single-celled organisms don't get fat, Skinny bitch, skinny wretch. After a while in one regimen, I get bored and want to try a new one. It's actually fun for me to read all the material and testimonials of the tanned, chamois doctors who stand by the diets medically. It's only a matter of time before the Jane Austen diet comes out, and I'm really looking forward to spending a spring adhering to that one. If someone called me chubby, it would no longer be something that kept me up late at night. Duante Diallo has no power over me anymore, unless he was deported and he's grown up to be an African warlord or something and has a machete. But being called fat is not like being called stupid or unfunny, which is the worst thing you could ever say about me. Do I envy Jennifer Hudson for being able to lose all that weight and look smoking hot? Of course, yes. Do I sometimes look at Victoria Beckham and wonder how awesome life would be if I never had to wear Spanx? Duh, of course, that's like the point of Victoria Beckham. I wish I could be like that, and maybe I will, once or twice, but for a very short period of time. I can't keep that kind of thing up. And on the list of things I want to do in my lifetime, being skinny is not near the top. I mean, it's not near the bottom, either. I'd say it's right above learn to drive a Vespa, but several notches below film a chase scene for a movie. I am not an athlete. I know. Pretty shocking, huh? I've always been extremely bad at anything athletic. I know it sounds like hyperbole here, but this isn't like one of those times when I say, I love that dress so much I want to kill myself. This is for real. The strange thing is, I love watching certain sports as much as I detest participating in them myself. In the early 1980s, when my family was fixated on the Celtics-Lakers rivalry, I sat in front of the TV with them thinking Larry Bird was the handsomest man in the world. For the record, at the age of 6, the criteria for handsome was simply, is he not related to me? Have I seen him on television? That's pretty much it. Larry Bird, Dick Clark, Andy Rooney, these are all handsome guys to 6-year-old Mindy. But if I was handed an actual basketball, I would instantly begin to cry. For me, doing sports was like meeting the Disney characters at Disney World. On TV, I loved Mickey Mouse. When I met the actual real-life Mickey, or rather, his impersonator, and he tried to hug me in his warm fuzzy suit, I recoiled in fear. Part 1. Bikes. I learned to ride a bike at age 12. That was crazy old for my neighborhood. I had been successfully avoiding learning for years, mostly by making a big show that I couldn't be torn away from whatever book I was reading. If my parents have any soft spot, it is for books. And I knew the best way to get out of chores or sports or talking to elderly relatives on the phone was by holding up a book and saying, but I'm just enjoying Little House on the Prairie so much. I may have read the entire Laura Ingalls Wilder canon simply to get out of raking the lawn with my brother. But when other girls in my grade were starting to get their periods and I still didn't know how to ride a bike, the jig was glaringly up. My dad finally had to get serious about this. Maybe he was worried I would go through life not participating in one of the great American pastimes. Maybe he thought I had the potential to become a great cyclist. Or maybe he thought riding a bike would be a great way to flee assailants. Presumably, he just wanted me to fit in with the kids who biked around and to make some friends, and not be that strange girl who stayed in every weekend watching Golden Girls with her mom. Fueling my fight against my dad's wishes was my enormous dislike of bikes. Bikes were horrible. Bikes always seemed to be scratching my legs, or the spoke was poking me, or something like that. Pebbles ended up in my ankle socks when I was on a bike. The seat felt sharp and hurt my crotch. The bike represented everything annoying and uncomfortable in my entire sheltered life. Wearing elbow pads, knee pads, and a helmet, I took my bike to the parking lot behind the Beth Shalom Synagogue across the street. Dad came with me, holding 2 huge bottles of Gatorade. I was obsessed, for some reason, with not getting dehydrated while learning to ride a bike, as though it were strenuous. It took me a week to find my balance, because once I took both feet off the ground, I employed the ace move of closing my eyes out of fear. "What are you doing? Open your eyes!" my dad shouted. So, it turns out that keeping your eyes open is the key to learning to ride a bike. Once I mastered balance, my dad left me alone to do bike drills so I'd have it ingrained. Doing drills until it's ingrained is actually a classic Indian technique of teaching children things that goes back to Sanskrit liturgical texts. Index cards and Sharpie pens are actually distinctly Indian cultural artifacts to me. I rode my bike for hours around the parking lot behind Beth Shalom. Let me remind you that this was before iPods. This was even before those bright yellow sports Walkmans. So with no music to listen to, I just biked around in circles talking to myself, like a kid on the cover of a Robert Cormier young adult novel, circling around puzzled Jewish families walking back to their cars. This is how I learned to ride a bike. What my dad didn't realize at the time was that while I was cementing the mechanics of riding the bike, I was also cementing my hatred for doing it. I just decided I hated it, and that was it. You cannot begin to understand the power of my irrational hatred as a 12-year-old, but it's the kind of hatred that lasts. It was the same mysterious and powerful hatred that reared its head later in life for other things, like hiking, or orientation games in college, or any kind of pageant whatsoever. Part 2. Frisbee. Even though I wisely chose a group of friends who weren't too athletic, the frisbee has been a recurring nuisance in my life. Frisbee, or disc, as I have been corrected angrily many times, is one of the few sports that artsy kids like to do, so we've inevitably crossed paths. A good thing to know about me is that I'm terrible at frisbee and I hate playing it. Catching it, obviously. Honestly, close your eyes. Can you seriously even picture me catching a frisbee? No, you can't even picture it in your imagination. But throwing it as well. It always goes down like this. My frisbee enthusiast friends insist that I would love frisbee if I were taught how to throw. I decline. They persist, and I relent. So, after careful instruction by my friends, but really, who has ever been able to make use of the advice, it's all in the wrist, I give it a shot. I hurl the frisbee, at some crazy fast speed and far distance, I have always had meaty, strong arms, in completely the wrong direction until it lands on the other side of the park and I ruin everybody's game. Unlike other athletes, frisbee people won't let it go. My theory is that this is because there's a huge overlap between people who are good at frisbee and people who do Teach for America. The same instinct to make at-risk kids learn, which I admire so much, becomes deadly when turned on friends trying to relax on a Sunday afternoon in the park. They feel like they have to corral me into learning this useless sport. The afternoon becomes unlocking Mindy's passion for frisbee, instead of just letting me lie on the grass reading my chick lit book. How dare you? If I had thought learning frisbee was a valuable thing to do, I would have done it. I don't want to learn. I don't want to learn. Let me read Shopaholic Runs for Congress in peace. Part 3. Ropes. There is a famous photo of my older brother Vijay, my cousin Hondo, and me climbing ropes at the Josiah Willard Hayden Recreation Center in Lexington, Massachusetts in 1984, when we were 7, 6, and 5 years old, respectively. Famous in the sense that the local newspaper, The Tab, ran the picture for some reason. I guess the sight of three little Indian kids in roughly identical outfits with roughly the same haircut climbing ropes was interesting to their readers. But I remember, even as a 5-year-old, thinking, why am I being made to do this? I have never seen mom or dad climbing ropes. You cannot tell me that this is useful. What the photo didn't show was that after it was taken, I climbed all the way up, which took about 40 minutes. Once at the top, I didn't like the view and refused to come down. Also, my thighs were badly chafed and I had to go to the bathroom. Eventually, my counselors had to hoist up a ladder and pull me down, much to the embarrassment of Vijay and Hondo. I'm pretty sure Vijay claimed that Hondo was a sibling and I the cousin. Luckily, the rope fiasco was eclipsed several weeks later, when I accidentally pronounced jalapeno with a hard J in front of Vijay, Hondo, and some other campers. I'd only ever seen it printed on the side of a can of salsa. You think it's jalapeno? Hondo asked, incredulous. I did. Part 4. Morse's Pond. Amazingly, there is actually another instance from my childhood where I froze in the middle of an athletic pursuit. And this time it was much more serious. It occurred at Wellesley Summer Day Camp, where my brother and I were shipped out as kids in the 80s. The camp made daily visits to Morse's Pond in Wellesley, Massachusetts. I didn't like Morse's Pond, because there was no snack bar or gift shop like at Walden Pond. Where it had a significant leg up over Walden was that at least it didn't have a scary ghost haunting it, which is who I assumed Henry David Thoreau was and why everyone made such a big deal about him. A few years after I swam there as a kid, they made Morse's Pond off limits to swimmers. Apparently, it was saturated with contaminated soil from an abandoned paint factory. To its credit, I can only remember it teeming with Canadian geese poop. Then, a few years after it was condemned, a rich physician hired a hitman to murder his wife there. This all really happened. I know what you're thinking. Morse's Pond? More like Remorse's Pond. But now it's open again. As a kid, I was curious but not remotely adventurous, if that makes sense. I wanted to climb the diving board to see the view out to the other side of Morse's Pond, but I didn't want to swim over there. The far side of the pond was so filled with weeds and algae that it was a pretty coppery color, and I wanted to get a better view of it. Once I got to the top of the ladder to the diving board, I could see all the way across the pond. The weeds and algae were indeed very pretty. Even further out, I saw Wellesley Center, where my favorite children's bookstore was. I was glad I did it, and I turned to climb down the ladder. That's when Scott, the handsome counselor who was waiting in the deep end of the pool, yelled up at me. Again, I'm not sure if he is actually handsome by today's standards or just handsome by my aforementioned criteria. Scott,
You're not allowed to climb back down the ladder. You have to dive.
I froze. This was the big kid diving board and really was extremely high. I inched backward, pretending not to hear. Scott.
Don't even think about it. It's against the rules. Once you're up there, there's only one way down.
Me. Is that the camp's rules or the pond's rules? There was a pause as Scott thought about this. It annoyed him that I had a follow-up question. Scott.
It's the same thing. You cannot climb back down.
Me. I really don't want to jump. Scott.
Well, you're just going to stand there, then.
Two bigger kids were now standing at the base of the ladder, impatiently waiting for their turn to jump. I think it was the most scared that I've ever been in my life. I was too scared to jump off, but also scared of getting in trouble with the camp, with the cabal of shadowy Morse's Pond officials, and of bringing shame to my family. And again, embarrassing Vijay, my brother. Summers at this point were just a terrifying countdown to the moment when I would somehow embarrass my poor older brother, whose shame stung worse than my own. Would I eat too many popsicles at lunch, leaving none for some other kid, and open myself up to the ridicule of Popsicle Hog? Would I get a mud stain on the back of my shorts and become shitty pants? Scott probably thought he was doing something really good for me. Or maybe this was something his mean stepdad did to him and he was exercising the bad experience on me. But whatever he was trying to do, it sucked. All I remember is crazy, panicky, ice-cold fear shooting through my limbs. Unable to say, screw you, dude, I'm going down this ladder, and I'm going to call my mom from the payphone, and she's going to come pick me up and take me home. I closed my eyes and just let myself fall into the water. The sight of a fat child falling lifeless from a high distance into a pond is kind of an amazing sight, I bet. You know when a kid's getting a shot or a tooth removed, how you tell them that's not going to be as bad as they're imagining it will be? Well, this was 100 times worse than I had imagined. First of all, it hurt. I don't know how it happened, but I got a huge cut from falling into the water. It was in the back of my left knee. To this day, I still have a 4-inch dark brown scar there. 3 people, including Scott, pull me out of the water. They rushed me to shore to the first aid room, which, weirdly, had injections for anaphylactic shock and eye wash, but no paper towels. Scott patted me down on the back of the leg with beach towels. Ultimately, they got it to stop bleeding, and Scott begged me not to tell my parents. I remember him asking me like 4 or 5 times. God knows what that must have looked like to an observer, a 17-year-old boy exhorting a disoriented, bleeding 6-year-old, not to tell her parents something, but this was Morse's Pond, and that's the kind of thing that happened there. Lessons? When I was a kid, my parents smartly raised us to keep quiet, to be respectful to older people, and generally not question adults all that much. I think that's because that they were assuming that 99% of the time, we'd be interacting with worthy, smart adults like my aunts and uncles, my teachers, my ancient and knowledgeable piano instructor, Mrs. Brewster, and police officers. They didn't ever tell me, sometimes you will meet idiots who are technically adults and authority figures. You don't have to do what they say. You can calmly say, can I first call my mom and ask her if I have to do this, please? But we didn't have cell phones back then. The only people who had cell phones were rich villains in action movies who you knew were going to die first. When I have kids, I will largely follow how my parents raised me, because, like everyone else on the planet, I think my parents are perfect, and so am I. But one thing I will impart to my children is, if you're scared of something, that isn't a sign that you have to do it. It probably means you shouldn't do it. Call Dad or call Mom immediately. A handful of bad experiences when I was small have made me a confirmed non-athlete. In psychology, okay, Twilight, they teach you about the notion of imprinting, and I think that applies here. I reverse imprinted with athleticism. Ours is the great non-love story of my life. Don't peak in high school. Sometimes teenage girls ask me advice about what they should do to have a career like mine one day. There are basically 2 ways to get where I am. 1, learn a provocative dance and put it on YouTube. 2, convince your parents to move to Orlando and get homeschooled until you get cast in a band. Or do what I did, which is 3, stay in school and be a respectful and hardworking little wallflower and go to an accredited non-online university. Teenage girls, please don't worry about being super popular in high school or being the best actress in high school or the best athlete. Not only do people not care about any of that the second you graduate, but when you get older, if you reference your successes in high school too much, it actually makes you look kind of pitiful. Like some babbling old Tennessee Williams character with nothing else going on in their current life. What I've noticed is that almost no one who was a big star in high school is also a big star later in life. For us overlooked kids, it's so wonderfully fair. I was never the lead in the play. I don't think I went to a single party with alcohol in it. No one offered me pot. It wasn't until I was 16 that I even knew marijuana and pot were the same thing. I didn't even learn this from a cool friend. I gleaned it from a syndicated episode of 21 Jump Street. My parents didn't let me do social things on weeknights because weeknights were for homework. And maybe an episode of X-Files if I was being a good kid. X-Files were on Friday night. And on extremely rare occasions, I could watch Seinfeld, Thursday, a school night, if I just aced my PSATs or something. It is easy to freak out as a sensitive teenager. I always felt I was missing out because of the way the high school experience was dramatized in television and song. For every realistic my so-called lives, there were 10 90210s or party of fives, where 20-something Luke Perry was supposed to be a typical guy at your high school. If Luke Perry had gone to my high school, everyone would have thought, what's the deal with this greaser? Is he a narc? Why is he at our school? But that's who Hollywood put forth as just the regular dude at your high school. In the genre of making you feel like you're not having an awesome American high school experience, the worst offender is actually a song. John Cougar Mellencamp's Jack and Diane. It's one of those songs like Eric Clapton's Tears in Heaven that everyone knows all the words to without ever having chosen to learn them. I've seen people get incredibly pumped when this song comes on. I once witnessed a couple request it 4 times in a row at Johnny Rockets and belt it while loudly clapping their hands above their heads. So apparently it is an anthem of some people's youth. I think across America, as I am saying this, there are high school couples who strive to be like Jack and Diane from that song. Just hanging out after school, making out at the Tasty Freeze, sneaking beers in their car, without a care in the world. Just two popular, idle, all-American white kids having a blast. The world created in Jack and Diane is maybe okay charming because, alright, that kid Jack, he's gonna get shipped off to Vietnam. And there's going to be a whole part two of the story where he returned as some kind of traumatized, disillusioned vet. The song is only interesting to me as the dreamy first act to a much more interesting Born on the 4th of July type story. As it is, I guess I find Jack and Diane a little disgusting. As a child of immigrant professionals, I can't help but notice the wasteful frivolity of it all. Why are these kids not home doing their homework? Why aren't they setting the table for dinner or helping around the house? Who allows their kids to hang out in parking lots? Isn't that loitering? I wish there was a song called Nguyen and Ari, a little ditty about a hard-working Vietnamese girl who helps her parents with the franchised Holiday Inn they run and does homework in the lobby. And Ari, a hard-working Jewish boy who does volunteer work at his grandmother's old age home, and they meet after school at the Princeton Review. Nguyen and Ari help each other study for the SATs and different AP courses, and then, after months of studying and mountains of flashcards, they kiss chastely upon hearing the news that they both got into their top college choices. Now this is a song that teens need to inadvertently memorize. This is a song that I would request at Johnny Rockets. In high school, I had fun in my academic clubs, watching movies with my girlfriends, learning Latin, having long, protracted, unrequited crushes on older guys who didn't know me. And yes, hanging out with my family. I liked hanging out with my family. Later, when you grow up, you realize you never get to hang out with your family. You pretty much only have 18 years to spend with them full time, and that's it. So yeah, it all added up to a happy, memorable time. Even though I was never a star and never a popular white kid. Because I was largely overlooked at school, I watched everyone like an observant weirdo, not unlike Eugene Levy's character Dr. Alan Pearl in Waiting for Guffman, who sat next to the class clown and studied him. But I did that with everyone. It has helped me so much as a writer you have no idea. I just want ambitious teenagers to know it is totally fine to be quiet, observant kids. Besides being a delight to your parents, you will find that you have plenty of time later to catch up. So many people I work with, famous actors, accomplished writers, were overlooked in high school. Be like Alan Pearl. Sit next to the class clown and study him. Then grow up, take everything you learned, and get paid to be a real-life class clown, unlike whatever unexciting thing the actual high school class clown is doing now. The chorus of Jack and Diane is, "Oh yeah, life goes on, long after the thrill of living is gone." Are you kidding me? The thrill of living was high school? Come on, Mr. Cougar Mellencamp. Get a life. Is everyone hanging out without me? Or, how I made my first real friend. In 9th grade, I had a secret friend. Her name was Mavis Lerman. Mavis lived a few streets away from me in a Tudor-styled house that every Halloween her parents made to look like an evil witch's cottage from Hansel and Gretel. This is amazing, by the way. It behooves anyone who lives in a Tudor-style house to make it look like a witch cottage on Halloween. The Lermans were a creative and eccentric family who my parents deemed good people. Mavis was my Saturday friend, which meant she came over to my house Saturday and we spent the afternoon watching television together. Mavis and I bonded over comedy. It didn't matter if it was good or bad. At 14, we didn't really know the difference. We were comedy nerds, and we just loved watching and talking about it nonstop. We burrowed up in my family's TV room with blankets and watched hours of Comedy Central. Keep in mind, this is not the Comedy Central of today, with the abundance of great shows like South Park, The Daily Show, and The Colbert Report. This was the early 90s, when you really had to search around to find decent stuff to watch. We'd start with the good shows, Dr. Katz, Kids in the Hall, or Saturday Night Live reruns. But when those were over, we were lucky if there was some dated movie playing, like Porky's or Kentucky Fried Movie. With all the raunchy 80s sex comedies Comedy Central played, at times it felt like we were watching a confusing softcore porn channel. It wasn't our favorite programming, but like the tray of croissants from Costco my mom left for us on the kitchen table, Mavis and I devoured it nonetheless. We loved comedy, and we wanted to watch everything. And more than that, we loved reenacting what we saw. The church lady's catchphrases were our catchphrases, and we repeated them until my mother said, exasperated, "Please stop saying, 'Isn't that special?' in that strange voice. It is annoying to me and to others." At 14, Mavis was already 5'10". She had short, dark, slick-back hair like Don Johnson in Miami Vice. She was very skinny and had women's size 11 feet. I know this because she accidentally wore my dad's boat shoes home one time. Mavis was a big, appreciative eater, which my parents loved. When she visited, she made a habit of immediately opening the fridge and helping herself to a heaping bowl of whatever leftover Indian food we had and a large glass of orange juice. "This roti and aloo gobi is delicious, Dr. Chokalingam," she said to my mother between bites. "You should really start a restaurant." My mother always protested when Mavis called her by the formal doctor name, but I think it secretly pleased her. She was sick of some of my other friends saying things like, "Hey, Swati, how's the practice going?" in that modern, we can call our parents by their first names fashion of liberally raised East Coast kids. Both my parents were very fond of Mavis. Who wouldn't love a hungry, complimentary, respectful kid? But that was Saturday. At school, I had a completely different set of friends. My posse at school was tight, and there was exactly four of us, Jana, Polly, Lauren, and me. We had been friends since middle school, which was only 2 years, but felt like a lifetime. The number of people in our friend group was important because of all the personalized friend gear we had that read JLMP, the first letters of our first names. We had JLMP beaded bracelets, JLMP embroidered bobby socks. We commissioned a caricature artist at Faneuil Hall in Boston to do a cartoon of the four of us, with JLMP in giant cursive letters underneath. These mementos cemented our foursome to both us and the other people at school. You couldn't get in, and you couldn't get out. Nothing says impenetrability and closeness like a silkscreen t-shirt with an acronym most people don't understand. JLMP knew who Mavis was. She was a lifer at our school, which meant that she'd been there since kindergarten and longer than any of us had been there. But she made no impact on our view of the social landscape. We didn't really talk about her or think about her. It was as though she was a substitute Spanish teacher or something. The Cheesecake Factory played a major role in JLMP's social life. We went there every Friday after school. These were our wild Friday night plans. Remember, this was back in the 90s, before the only way to be a cool teenager was to have a baby or a reality show or both. We'd stay at Cheesecake Factory for hours, chewing on straws and gossiping about boys, and collectively only spend about $15 on one slice of cheesecake and four Cokes. Then we'd leave and have our regular dinners at our respective homes. Obviously, the waiters loathed us. In a way, we were worse than the Dine & Dashers, because at least the Dine & Dashers only hit up Cheesecake Factory once and never showed up again. We, on the other hand, thought we were beloved regulars and that people lit up when we walked in. "We're back, Cheesecake Factory! JLMP's back! Your favorite cool young people here to jazz up the joint." I know what you're thinking, that I ditched Mavis because she wasn't as cool as my more classically girly friends. But that wasn't it. First of all, JLMP wasn't even very cool. High school girls who have time to be super cliquey are usually not the popular girls. The actual popular girls have boyfriends, and by that point have chilled out on intense girl friendships to explore sex and stuff. Not us. Sex? Forget it. JLMP had given up on that happening until grad school. Yep, we were the kind of girls who, at age 14, pictured ourselves attending grad schools and losing our virginities there. Getting a good idea of us now? Mavis had her own friends. Maybe because of her height and her short hair, she hung out with mostly guys. Her crowd was the techie boys, the ones who built the sets at school and proudly wore all black, covered in dried paint splatter. The techie boys all had fancy names like Conrad and Xander and Sebastian. It's as if their parents had hoped that by naming them these manly, ornate names, they might have a fighting chance of being the leading men in our school. Unfortunately, the actual leading men in our school were named Matt, or Rob, or Chris, and wouldn't be caught dead near a student theater unless they were receiving a soccer trophy in a sports assembly. Mavis and her guy pals built gorgeous sets for our plays like Evita, Rags, and City of Angels, and got absolutely zero recognition for it. They were just kind of expected to build the sets, like the janitors were expected to clean up the hallways. Though Mavis could have been confused for a boy from almost every angle, she had the pale skin and high cheekbones of an Edith Wharton character. Thinking back on her now, she had all the prerequisites to be a runway model in New York, especially since this was the early 90s when it was advantageous to look like a flat-chested, rail-thin boy. But our school was behind the times, and the aesthetic that ruled was the curvy, petite, all-American Tiffany Amber Thiessen look, which Polly and Lauren had to some degree. At school, Mavis was considered neither pretty nor popular. Neither was I, by any stretch of the imagination, but at least I didn't tower over the boys in our class by a good 5 inches. We both lived by a weird code. Mavis and I might be friends on Saturday afternoon, but Friday afternoons and weekend sleepovers were for JLMP. If it sounds weird and compartmentalized, that's because it was. But I was used to compartmentalization. My entire teenage life was a highly organized map of activities. 20-minute shower to get ready for school, 5-minute breakfast, 45-minute Latin class, to a 30-minute lunch, to 45-minute jazz band rehearsal, etc. Compartmentalizing friendships did not feel different to me. Mavis and I would say, hi, in the hallways, and we would nod at each other. Occasionally, we would sit next to each other in study hall. But Mavis did not fit into my life as my school friend. Then, things started to change. One Saturday night, I had JLMP over my house. They wanted to watch Sleeping with the Enemy. You know, the movie where Julia Roberts fakes her own death to avoid being married to her psycho husband. And I wanted to watch Monty Python's Flying Circus and show them The Ministry of Silly Walks, one of their funniest and most famous sketches. Mavis and I had watched it earlier that day several times in a row, trying to imitate the walks ourselves. I played it for JLMP. No one laughed. Lauren said, I don't get it. I played it again. Still no response to it. I couldn't believe it. The very same sketch that made Mavis and me clutch our chests in diaphragm-hurting laughter had rendered my best friends bored and silent? I made the classic mistake of trying to explain why it was so funny, as though a great explanation would be the key to eliciting a huge laugh from them. Eventually, Polly said gently, I guess it's funny in a random kind of way. Within an hour, we were watching Julia Roberts flushing her wedding ring down the toilet and starting a new life in Iowa under assumed identity. I could barely enjoy the movie, still stunned by my closest friend's utter lack of interest in something I loved so much. I'd always known, yeah, maybe JLMP wouldn't be as interested in comedy as Mavis had been, but it scared me that they dismissed it so completely. I felt like two different people. What happened to me was something that I think happens to a lot of professional comedy writers or comedians, or really anyone who's passionate about anything and discovering it for the first time. Most people who do what I do are obsessed with comedy, especially during adolescence. I think we all have that moment when our non-comedy obsessed friends and families are like, nope, I'm at my limit. I can't talk about In Living Color anymore. It's kind of funny, but come on. And more, I found that I didn't want to do what JLMP wanted to do. Like one time, Lauren wanted me to go to the yarn store in Harvard Square with her so we could both learn to knit. I reluctantly used my allowance to buy a skein of yarn. Who was I knitting stuff for? If I gave my mother a knitted scarf, she would be worried I was wasting my time doing stupid stuff like knitting instead of schoolwork. Presenting a homemade knitted object to my parents was actually like handing them a detailed backlog of my idleness. And Jana, sweet old Jana, she was crazy about horses. Like super nutso crazy about horses. That was her thing. All her drawings and back from vacation stories and Halloween costumes were horses. She would even pretend to be a horse during free period and lunch. We'd defeat her pizza out of her hand and she would neigh back, thank you. Now I was getting a little bored of driving 45 minutes with her parents to the equestrian center to pretend to care about her galloping back and forth in her horse recital or whatever. I found myself wanting to spend more time with Mavis than JLMP. I spent the week looking forward to Saturday so I could write sketches with her. I didn't want her to be my secret friend anymore. One Friday in November, I didn't go to Cheesecake Factory with JLMP. I asked Mavis if she wanted to hang out at the mall after school. We had never spent time together outside of our houses. Mavis was surprised but agreed to go. We went to the Arsenal Mall after school. We bought sour gummy worms at the bulk candy store. We rocked around Express and the Limited, trying things on and buying nothing. It felt weird being with Mavis in the real world, but good weird. The next Friday, I bailed on JLMP again, so my brother, Mavis, and I could see Wayne's World together. We spent the whole night afterwards chanting, Wayne's World, party time, excellent, schwing! The following Friday, we went to her house, where Mr. Learman showed us how to use his camcorder so we could tape a sketch we had written, which used the characters in Gap Girls, that old SNL sketch with Chris Farley, Adam Sandler, and David Spade dressed up as female Gap employees. Mavis played David Spade and Adam Sandler. I played Chris Farley and all the other characters. Sometime around then, Mavis and I became real friends, friends at school. I spent most of winter break with Mavis, going to Harvard Square to see movies and buying comic books. I discovered she wasn't into going shopping as much as JLMP had been, but I had my mom and Aunt Trula for that anyway. I still considered JLMP my best friends, but began flaking on them more and more. Jana's mom even called my mom to tell her how hurt Jana was that I'd missed a big horse show. One Friday evening in mid-February, Mavis and I were at the Radio Shack trying to find a tripod to use with her dad's camcorder. It was the mall with JLMP's Cheesecake Factory. On the escalator ride down, you could see right into the restaurant. That's when Mavis and I saw it. Jana, Polly, and Lauren were sitting in a booth together. They were laughing and talking over a slice of cheesecake, but without me. Just JLP. I was so hurt and embarrassed. Yeah, I'd made another friend, but does that give them the right to orchestrate a hangout where I was so glaringly left out? For a second, I hated Mavis. I wasn't sure why exactly. Maybe for witnessing this humiliation, or for unwittingly being the cause of it. My immediate reaction was to rush over to them and confront them. But then I thought, why? What was I going to do with them after I confronted them? Sit with them and gossip about things I didn't really care about anymore? Mavis said quietly, if you want to go with them, I totally get it. There was something about the unexpectedly kind way she said that that made me happy to be with her and not with them. For some reason, I immediately thought about how my parents had always been especially fond of Mavis. And here was this moment when I understood exactly why. She was a good person. It felt so good to realize how smart my parents had been all along. Are you kidding me? I said. We have to go home and film this sketch. By the time I got down the escalator and walked to the parking lot to get picked up by her parents, my ego was still bruised, but I was also able to identify another feeling, relief. Pretty soon after that, the rest of JLP disintegrated too. Polly was getting to music more and was getting chummier with the kids who all smoked regularly across the street in the fairy woods. It was Jana, surprisingly, who first got a boyfriend. A cool Thai kid named Prem, who was a senior, asked her out. Prem was pretty possessive, and within weeks, Jana was learning Thai and I never saw her. Lauren, with whom I had the least in common, faded out quickly without the buffer of the other two. It was almost a lifting of a burden when we weren't required to stay in touch. By the end of freshman year, it was just Mavis and me. I once half-jokingly suggested naming our friendship M&M, and Mavis looked at me with friendly but mild disgust. That was so not Mavis's style. She stayed friends with her techie guy friends, and I even had lunch with them sometimes. They were smart guys, funny and edgier than any other guys at school, and they were knowledgeable about politics, a subject barely anyone cared about. But my friend group definitely shrunk. I was without a posse, no small herd to confidently walk down the halls with. There was just Mavis and me, but it never seemed lonely because we never stopped talking. I could have an argument in earnest about who was the best kid from Kids in the Hall without having to explain who they were. One friend with whom you have a lot in common is better than three with whom you struggle to find things to talk about. We never needed best friend gear because I guess with real friends, you don't have to make it official. It just is. Junior year of high school, the Learmans moved to Evanston, Illinois, but Mavis and I kept in touch. She would call me and tell me about the amazing shows her dad took her to see at Second City, and we planned for me to visit, but it never materialized. When we graduated high school, she went to Cooper Union in Manhattan to pursue her love of set design, and I went to Dartmouth to pursue my love of white people and North Face parkas. We emailed a bit for a year or so, but by sophomore year, the email stopped. We both just got so consumed with college. I would be reminded of Mavis when my parents asked about her over summer and holiday breaks. How is Mavis doing these days? My mother would ask. I think pretty good, I replied vaguely, reminding myself to send her an email one of these days but never following through. Mavis helped me learn so much about who I am and who I wanted to be. I love comedy and now surround myself with people who love to talk about it just as much as I do. I like to think that Polly is in a band, that Lauren joined the right knitting circle, and that Jana found a nice horse to settle down with. Even though Mavis was my secret friend, she is the only one I hope I see again. She's the only one I wonder about. I hope she wonders about me too. I love New York, and it likes me okay. Failing at everything in the greatest city on earth. I was hesitant to write this essay because, of course, I would rather have you guys think I'm some kind of wide-eyed wunderkind who just kind of floated into my job at the office without even trying. I want you to picture me as a cute little anime character that popped up from behind a mushroom or something and landed in Hollywood. Besides, who wants to hear about success anyway? Successful serial murderers, maybe. College ruined me. Not to sound braggy or anything, but I kind of killed it in college. You know that saying, big fish in a small pond? At Dartmouth College, I was freaking Jaws in a community swimming pool. I wrote plays, I acted, I sang, I was a student newspaper cartoonist. All this, of course, was less a function of my talent than of the schools being in rural New Hampshire, where the only option for real entertainment was driving 1.5 hours to Manchester on the off chance the Capitol steps were touring there. After beer pong, floating in an inner tube down the Connecticut River, fraternity hazing rituals, building effigies and burning them down in the center of our quad, a cappella, and driving to Montreal for strip clubs, student-run theatrical productions placed a strong 7th in terms of what was fun to do on campus. We had a captive audience with low standards, which was a recipe for smashing success and the reason for the inflated sense of self that I have to this very day. If you're a kid who is not especially a star in high school, I recommend going to a college in the middle of nowhere. I got all the attention I could ever have wanted. If I had gone to NYU, right now I'd be the funniest paralegal in a law firm in Boston. I got even more confidence from having a steadfast companion in my best friend, Brenda. A few words about Brenda. Bren is the shit. In college, she was the star of every play at Dartmouth from her freshman fall on. She looked the way a Manhattan socialite should look. Perfect posture, gazelle-like, with a sheet of dark blonde hair. Girls always worried she was going to steal their boyfriends, but she never did. I don't understand that at all. It's college. Steal some boyfriends, for God's sake. Bren and I befriended each other early on, became inseparable through a shared sense of humor, a trove of nonsensical private jokes, and had the same enemies within the drama department. We clung to each other with blind loyalty, like Lord Voldemort and his snake Nagini. I, of course, was Nagini. If you messed with one of us, you knew you messed with both of us, and Voldemort was going to cast a murder spell on you, or Nagini was going to chomp on your jugular. It was such a good, dramatic time. Bren was the kind of best friend I dreamed about having when I was a little kid. In theater, Bren would play Beatrice or Medea or Eliza Doolittle while I wrote plays and occasionally played Medea's little buddy or something. I felt like a big celebrity on campus. Well, the kind of celebrity you could conceivably be at Dartmouth if you weren't a jock or a sorority girl, who were the real celebrities. My fame was akin to that of, say, Camilla Parker Bowles. Our other best friend Jocelyn, whom we met through our singing group, was more or less the one directly responsible for making the traditional college experience really fun. She was less competitive and intense, and from Hawaii, so she was very comfortable being naked, which was new to us and intimidating. She'd make us go berry picking or get our faces painted for football games, and she'd host dinners in our shared dorm dining room. Jocelyn is willowy and half Asian, and while fitting the bill technically for a model, has no interest in modeling. She's just that cool. Me, on the other hand, whenever I lose like 5 pounds, I basically start considering if I should try out modeling. When the three of us walk down the street together, I look like the Indian girl who kept them real. I don't care. After all these years with friends who are 5'10 or taller, I have come to carry myself with the confidence of a tall person. It's all in the head. It works out. So I left college feeling like a successful, awesome, tall person. Then, in July of 2001, the three of us moved to New York. Late night dreams quickly extinguished. The job I wanted most in the world was to be a writer for Late Night with Conan O'Brien. I can't believe that was 2 Conan shows ago. It seems like yesterday. I'd been an intern at Late Night 3 years before and was famously one of the worst interns the program had ever seen. The reason I was bad was because I treated my internship as a free ticket to watch my hero perform live on stage every day, and not as a way to help the show run smoothly by doing errands. My boss, the script coordinator, greatly disliked me, not only because I was bad at my job, but also because hating everything was one of her personality traits. You know those people who legitimize their sarcastic, negative personalities by saying proudly that they are, quote, lifelong New Yorkers, unquote? She was one of those. Her favorite catchphrase was, "Are you on crack?" On my last day, she shook my hand limply and said a terse, "Bye," without looking away from her J. Crew catalog. When I arrived in New York, I didn't even really know how to apply for the job. I had not kept in touch with anyone at late night because even as a 19-year-old, I knew that no one wants to keep in touch with the intern. I had placed a lot of faith in